she could find no gap in his defences. His sword or shield blocked her cuts, overhead, side on, and even sweeping up from knee height. Sometimes he only managed to get his sword or shield into position at the last moment, but he managed nevertheless. Cassandra, knowing that speed was her best weapon, continued the assault, searching for an opening, seeking a relaxation in his defence. She didn't find one. Eventually, Mykeru cried, "Enough!" The two combatants lowered their swords and stepped back. Both were breathing heavily from their exertions, and from the flood of adrenaline that coursed through their bodies. They eyed each other balefully. There was no room for friendship in this contest. They were practicing for war. The time might come when such a competition was a matter of life and death. Mykeru had dinned into their brains the basic message of weapons practice. "Practice as you mean to fight," he had told them. No quarter, no sporting gestures, just a single-minded dedication to winning the bout. Here, losing might mean a painful bruise. In a real battle, the result would be death. "Come," Mykeru said to them, pointing to the floor in front of him. They made their way back from the end of the hall, where Cassandra had driven Daimon, and stood attentively before him. Cassandra wiped perspiration from her forehead with the sleeve of her padded jacket. The jacket was stained and grimy, and Maddie wondered if the armourers ever thought to launder them. Mykeru frowned, studying the princess for several seconds, then spoke. "Your speed is excellent. You gave your opponent no time to begin his own attack." Daimon nodded agreement. "She's wickedly fast. Several times there, I barely managed to get my sword or shield in position in time." Mykeru looked at him, his dark eyes steady and unblinking. "Yet manage you did," he said simply, and Daimon shrugged. The swordmaster turned his attention back to Cassandra. "You see, my lady," he said, "your speed is your best weapon. But the longer a combat lasts, the more it will be reduced. You become tired. Your arms are heavy. The katana, once so light and easy to wield, begins to weigh down your arms so that the muscles ache." He paused and raised an interrogative eyebrow at her. "That's a pretty good description of the way I feel," she admitted. He nodded. "Your speed and agility are not infinite resources," he said. "They only serve you for a certain time. Then they begin to deteriorate. And then," he emphasized the word heavily, "your opponent's greater strength and force become the dominant factors in your fight." Cassandra frowned, but Mykeru held up his hand to stop her. "When you are facing a skilled opponent like Daimon-san, you must find a way to end the bout quickly, before his advantages, his weight, his strength, and his power become the dominant ones." "Well, I was trying to do that," Cassandra said. Her face was reddening a little, Maddie noticed. Her mother had always had a quick temper, as Maddie knew only too well. "You were trying the same thing over and over," Mykeru told her. "If it didn't work the first time, why should it work on subsequent attempts?" "But you've told me that speed is my best weapon," Cassandra said, an argumentative tone in her voice. Mykeru nodded. "But not your only weapon. Daimon-san found a way to counteract your speed, and to make you waste your energy against his defences, until you became tired and your speed was diminished. When this happens, you must look for something unexpected, Otherwise, as the bout goes on, it becomes more certain that he will be the victor. Unexpected, Cassandra repeated. What do you mean by that? Remember your three best allies, speed, agility, and surprise. Faced with a foe like this, you have to surprise him before it's too late. Your overhand, side cut, and diagonal cuts were not fast enough to break his defense. Look for something else. Such as? Cassandra asked. Diamond and Maddie watched keenly, sensing that this was a new plateau in the Princess Regent's swordsmanship. One example might be a single-handed thrust, Maikeru told her quietly. She opened her mouth to speak, stopped, and thought. Then she said slowly, "But you say I must always fight two-handed." Before she had finished, Maikeru was shaking his head. "There is no always," he told her. "You must be ready to change, to adapt, to try something new and unexpected." In a sudden blur of motion, he dropped the wooden rod and drew his own katana from its scabbard. Then he lunged forward, holding it in one hand, the single cutting edge facing upward. The point stopped a bare 2 centimeters from the startled Cassandra's face. Instantly, in a continuation of his first movement, Maikeru withdrew the weapon and resheathed it. He bowed an apology to Cassandra. She waved it aside, looking at him with renewed interest. "By using one hand, you increase your reach by almost 0.5 meters, he said. "This alone will take your opponent by surprise, as well as the fact that most of your attacks to this moment have been with the edge, not the point." He paused to see if she was following. She nodded. "It's a risky move for you, because it leaves you open to a counterattack. You must be ready to recover instantly if the thrust doesn't go home." Again Cassandra nodded. Then she gestured at the sword in its scabbard. "You reversed your wrist so that the cutting edge was uppermost," she said. "What was the reason for that?" Maikeru nodded approvingly. "You notice small details," he said. "That's good." He drew his sword again, more slowly this time, and demonstrated the reversed wrist position, with the cutting edge on top. The katana's blade had a slight curve, imparting a downward direction to the thrust. "By reversing my wrist, I make the point of the katana travel slightly downward because of the curved blade. That means the sharp cutting edge can shear more easily through your opponent's chainmail. The edge is sharp enough to do that," he added. Cassandra nodded, eyes narrowed as she studied the gleaming blade. "I see," she said slowly. "Practice it with me," Maikeru told her. He stood beside her, demonstrating how to progress from an obliquely angled cut into the thrust, releasing the left hand from the grip, turning the wrist and stepping forward, all in one smooth movement. Cassandra copied the sequence several times, gradually moving faster and faster. As her movements became more confident, Maikeru stepped away, resheathing his katana and watching her closely. He bent and retrieved his wooden rod and began to tap a tempo on the floor once more. Then, with his free hand, he gestured down the length of the hall. "Move," he instructed her, "and change to the thrust every 3 strokes. Vary the sequence so you become used to thrusting after any other stroke." She shuffled down the hall, her light slippers whispering on the boards. Then, with every 3rd stroke, She stamped her right foot forward and lunged, point down and cutting edge uppermost. Maikeru let her reach the far end of the hall before he called out, "Now, back again!" The tapping of the rod on the boards became more rapid, and Cassandra moved toward them, the katana like a striking snake. Cut, cut, slash, thrust, cut, cut, sweep, thrust. She stopped in front of him, and he nodded approvingly. "Now try it with Daimon-san." Daimon held out a hand, protesting. "But I'll know she's going to do it every third stroke." Maikeru smiled grimly. "But only she will know when those three strokes begin," he said. Daimon nodded his understanding. They assumed their ready positions, and Maikeru once more called for them to begin. This time, Daimon struck first, aiming an overhead blow at Cassandra. Her wooden blade flickered out, and she deflected his stroke, so that the practice sword rebounded from the floorboards, throwing him slightly off balance. Seizing her opportunity, Cassandra delivered a barrage of cuts, slashes, and sweeps. Then, after six of these, she suddenly lunged one-handed. Daimon only just managed to recoil away from the tip of her blade, stumbling slightly, but bringing his shield up to block the thrust. Once more, she began to cut and slash at him. This time, she waited four strokes, then lunged. But he was ready. His shield caught her sword and deflected it away from him. Then, as she was still leaning forward, unbalanced and open to his reply, his sword flashed forward and struck her on the outer thigh. They stepped back. It had been a winning blow. In a real fight, it would not have killed her outright. But even if it hadn't severed any of the major blood vessels in her leg, it would have taken her right leg out from under her and left her at his mercy. "Again," Maikeru said quietly, and once more the hall resounded with the rapid impacts of wood on wood. Then, Cassandra essayed another thrust, with the same result. Diamond's shield blocked her katana. His sword whipped out and caught her on the hip. Cassandra stepped back, her cheeks flaming with effort and frustration. She rubbed her left hand against her hip. There would be a bruise there tonight, she realized. "This is hopeless," she said angrily. Maikeru regarded her with a half-smile. "You think so?" "I know so," she replied, still angry. "The thrust leaves me open to a reply, as you said, and Daimon has no trouble avoiding it. Why bother with such a useless tactic?" Maikeru turned his impassive gaze to Daimon. "You noticed?" When the young captain nodded, Maikeru indicated Cassandra. "Tell her." "You're signaling the thrust," Daimon said apologetically. "I know when you're going to try it." He paused, then elaborated. "Actually, I didn't know the first time, but after that, it was obvious." "What was so blasted obvious?" Cassandra knew it wasn't fair to vent her anger on a subordinate like Daimon. He couldn't respond in kind. Nonetheless, her quick temper overcame her sense of fairness. "Before you thrust, you raise your chin slightly," Daimon told her. She drew breath for a heated reply, then realized he might be right. She looked at Maikeru for confirmation, and the grey-haired swordmaster nodded. "Every time," he said. "It's a habit you'll have to break. Otherwise, it could cost you your life." Cassandra considered his words, glanced at Daimon, and nodded. "Thanks," she said. I'll have to work on that. 12. The days passed, and time began to hang heavy on Maddie's hands. She went hunting with Diamond, which was a welcome diversion. The young captain offered her the use of a bow, but she declined. It wasn't a good idea to let anyone, even a captain of the castle guard, know about her skill with a bow. Most young women of her age and social station could shoot, but her ability was far beyond what might be expected, and that could lead to questions. It was vital that she protect her secret life as an apprentice ranger, so she thought it best not to show any skill with the bow at all. And since she wasn't sure that she could fake being less of an archer than she was, the best way was to use her sling exclusively. At least that wasn't known as a weapon of choice for rangers. Diamond was a capable shot, but she could see that she was far better, and she was glad of her decision. She bagged 2 large hares with her sling, and he shot a young deer, bringing it down after stalking it for 30 minutes. The deer would go to the castle kitchens, as would the 2 hares, and would provide meat for the main dining hall. Maddie was glad he elected to end the hunt then, rather than continue on, killing for the sake of killing. Diamond hunted only for the table, not for sport or for trophies. She liked that in him. Additionally, she enjoyed his cheerful company, and they spent 3 pleasant hours together while they hunted. But, with Horace and Gillen absent, and more than half of the castle garrison with them, Diamond's free time was limited. He was in command of the remaining troops, and he took his responsibility seriously. Maddie regretted that they had little time to spend together, but appreciated that he attended so conscientiously to his duties. Her mother, too, was busy. Horace's absence meant that a lot of the administrative work he usually undertook now fell to her. Maddie regretted that they had no time for more practice bouts with Diamond and Maikeru, although she knew her mother did manage to fit in several sessions with the swordmaster. She rode out to Warwick and Lou's farm several times, switching over to Bumper to patrol the area. Warwick reported that there had been no sign of lights in the old abbey since she had been there last. She rode up to inspect the building once. But aside from the cold ashes of an old fire, doubtless left by travellers, there was no sign that anybody had been there in recent days. The fact was, Araluen was a far more peaceful fief than Redmond. This was in part because of the relatively large garrison at Castle Araluen, and that the area around it had been settled for many years. Redmond, by comparison, was on the outer fringe of the kingdom, closer to the Hibernian Sea, with its pirates and smugglers, and the border with Celtica. There was far more going on in Redmond Fief. More action. More activity. There was more to keep a ranger and his apprentice occupied and on the alert. Araluen Fief was boring by comparison, especially for an adventurous young woman like Maddie. The result was that, after a few more days, she became restive and unsettled, and was looking for something to occupy her mind. The answer came in a conversation with her grandfather, whom she visited most days, sometimes for an hour or so, at other times, if he was tired, for a few minutes.
"Have you explored the castle?"
he asked her one day after she complained of being bored by the enforced inactivity. She shrugged. "I grew up here," she reminded him. "I think I've seen everything there is to see." He smiled and tapped his finger against the side of his nose.
"Ah, but what about what isn't to be seen?"
she frowned.
"What isn't to be seen?"
she repeated, not understanding.
It's rumoured there are lots of secret places within these walls, some inside the walls themselves.
Secret places? You mean tunnels? She asked. Her interest sparked.
Tunnels, yes, and stairways. It's rumoured that my grandfather had a secret way out of the castle, a tunnel that led under the moat.
Duncan smiled.
Seems he had a girlfriend in the village, and he liked being able to sneak out to see her.
Gillen said something about that. Where is it?
Maddie asked.
He shook his head.
I never had time to look for it when I was younger, he said.
But it strikes me that it might be useful to know about such things.
I imagine it would begin somewhere in the cellars.
But where? You said secret stairways as well,
Maddie prompted him.
Most of these old castles had secret ways to access the towers, usually by a narrow stairway built inside the walls. Can't see why Araluin would be any different. They must be here somewhere.
He looked around the room, indicating the thick stone walls.
Maddie rose and prowled around the room, stopping to tap on the walls every few meters or so.
They sounded disappointingly solid, she thought.
How would one go about finding such things? She mused, half to herself.
Duncan shrugged, the movement causing him a slight twinge of pain in his injured leg.
The castle library might be a place to start, he said. Ask for old plans and sketches of the castle. Look for anomalies.
Such as?
He rubbed his stubbly chin.
His servant hadn't shaved him so far this morning.
Well, look for rooms that should be the same dimensions but aren't.
Walls that are shorter than the rooms above and below them, or adjoining them. Look for variations in their measurements. Sometimes that will indicate the presence of a hidden chamber.
And in the cellars and lower levels of the castle, she said.
Duncan nodded.
That's where I'd start.
She stayed with him for another half hour.
The conversation turned to other matters,
but she was distracted by the idea of secret stairways and tunnels continuing to pop into her mind.
Finally, she rose and took her leave. She kissed him gently on the forehead and moved to the door. As she laid her hand on the latch, he stopped her.
"Give my regards to Master Aldred," he said.
She looked back at him, her head cocked to one side.
"Aldred?"
"The head librarian. Been here for years. He should know where to lay his hands on the old charts and plans of the castle."
The library was on the first floor of the keep, in a large, well-ventilated annex set on the western side. High-level windows admitted the sun, letting it shine down on the stacks of books and scrolls that were packed into shelves twice the height of a man. Aldred was a thin wisp of a man, with long, unkempt grey hair, cut short in the front, but hanging halfway down his back. He was dressed in a monk-like scholar's robe, with a long hood hanging at the back, and a belt made of silken cord. It occurred to Maddie that most scholarly types were small in build. Heavier set or taller men tended to become warriors. When Maddie entered, Aldred was presiding over the library from a mezzanine balcony that overlooked the rows of shelves, sitting at a large table that had several volumes and scrolls stacked neatly on one side.
"Your Highness," he said, smiling a welcome. "What brings you to my domain?"
"Please, call me Maddie," she said, smiling in reply.
"Your Highness is far too formal."
He inclined his head, pleased by her friendly and informal approach.
"Maddie it is, then," he said. "What can I do for you?"
The king said, "You might be able to show me the original plans and sketches of the castle," she said. He regarded her with a knowing look. "Looking for secret tunnels, perhaps?" She raised her eyebrows in surprise. "Yes. How did you know that?" Aldred sighed. "It's why most people want to study the plans. So far, nobody's found anything," he told her. "Not that too many of them kept at it for long. They become bored and skip through the plans quickly. Never find anything that way." "Well, I'll try to stay focused. Can you show them to me?" He shook his head. "I've got too much work right now, but I can show you where to find them." "That'd be fine," she told him. "Then follow me," he said, rising from behind his work table and leading the way to the wooden stairway that descended to the library floor. He moved quickly, and she had to hurry to keep up with him. He preceded her to the eastern corner and stopped, indicating a section of shelves packed with rolled scrolls and large, leather-bound volumes. "They're all there," he said. "I'm sorry I can't let you take them out of the library, but there's a table and chair here you can use to study them. Oh, and a pen, ink and paper, if you want to make notes." She walked to the shelves and studied the array of scrolls, hesitating as she sought a place to start. "They're labelled," Aldred told her, seeing her uncertainty. "I'd start with the lower levels. Doubt you'll find a tunnel at the top of a tower, after all." She grunted a reply and peered more closely, seeing the labels on the shelves under the scrolls. She reached out for one. "Cellar level 1," she read aloud. "That's as good a place as any." "I'd say so," Aldred told her. Then he turned away. "I'll be back at my desk if you need anything." He paused. "Oh, and put everything back where it came from, won't you?" Maddie nodded, taking the heavy rolled scroll from the shelf and blowing a little dust from it. Obviously, nobody had looked at it for some time. She moved to the table he'd indicated, untied the ribbon securing the scroll, and rolled it open. There were half a dozen lead weights on the table, and she used 4 of them to hold the scroll open, then bent over it to study it. Engrossed in her task, she didn't hear Aldred as he walked quickly back through the shelves toward his lofty perch. She pored over the chart, initially not fully understanding what she was seeing. She lowered herself into the chair and thought for several minutes. "I guess the best way is to get accustomed to all these drawings and measurements," she said quietly to herself. "After all, it's not likely that there'd be a label saying, 'Tunnel here.' I'll need to suss it out." She spent the next hour and a half going over the charts and plans, until she was familiar with the style of them. By the end of that time, her eyes were watering with the effort of concentration. The lines, measurements, and notes were beginning to swim before her eyes. Reluctantly, she rolled up the parchment scroll she had been studying and retied the ribbon around it. She replaced it in the shelves and picked up her sheets of notes, then retraced her way through the shelves to the ladder stairs that led to Aldred's office. Mounting them quickly, she coughed to gain his attention, and he looked up, smiling. "Finished?" She shook her head. "Just starting. I'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for your help." She turned and left the room, and he watched her as she walked briskly through the rows of shelves to the entrance. "Well, good for you," he said softly.
13. The following morning, after breakfast, she was back at the library, waiting for Aldred to open up. He arrived after a few minutes and smiled to see her there.
"Getting an early start?"
He unlocked the big double doors and let her in. Maddie went immediately to the shelves where the plans were kept, and took out the scrolls for cellar level 1 and cellar level 2, the upper and lower cellars beneath the keep. She had thought about her task as she lay in bed the previous evening, and today she had a plan of action. She set out her pen, ink, and sheets of notepaper. Then she laid a graduated scale beside them, one she had taken from her father's desk. It was a flat rule, marked in centimetres, and about 30 centimetres long. He used it to measure distances on his scale maps when he was planning a journey or a campaign. She studied the plan of the upper cellar. It was a rectangular room, 30 metres long and 10 wide. At one end were racks for wine barrels and storage bins for dried fruit and vegetables. Along each of the 2 longer walls, 6 indentations were marked. Small rectangular rooms that she knew were used as cells for prisoners. In some castles, they would be called dungeons, and they'd be poorly lit and ventilated, with water dripping down the walls. Here, she knew, they were at least clean and dry. At the moment, none of them was occupied. She placed her scale rule along the long side of the cellar and measured it. The 30-metre length corresponded to 15 centimetres on the scale. She made a note of the fact, then rolled the scroll up, refastened it, and reached for the plans of cellar level 2, the rooms directly below. At first glance, it appeared identical to the room above. But then her eyes narrowed, and she frowned thoughtfully as she noticed an anomaly. Ranged along the 2 long walls of the cellar were the same rectangular indentations denoting cells. But whereas the upper cellar had 6 on each side, cellar level 2 had only 5. Quickly, she placed her rule against the longest side and measured it, 12.5 centimetres. That indicated that the lower wall was 25 metres long, 5 metres shorter than the room above it. "How come nobody's noticed that before?" she mused aloud. Then she realized that the 2 plans were on separate sheets. Chances were, nobody had ever placed them side by side to compare them, or measured the length of the walls for comparison. Or maybe they had, and had simply accepted the fact that the lower cellar was shorter. It was significant to her only because she was looking for a concealed passage. But now that she had noticed it, the question was, why was cellar 2 5 metres shorter than cellar 1? One way to find out, she said to herself. She rolled up the 2nd set of plans, refastened them, and placed both scrolls back on the shelves. She planned to come back to the library, so she stacked her notes, pen and rule neatly on the table and hurried to the door. She debated saying goodbye to Aldred, then decided against it. He'd only ask her if she'd found something, and she didn't want to appear foolish if her idea turned out to be a wild goose chase. She made her way down to the cellars underneath the keep. Since there were no prisoners in the cells, there was no call for anyone to be stationed down here. But the area was well lit with torches in brackets on the wall, and 3 lanterns hanging from the low stone ceiling. Obviously, members of the castle staff came in each morning and lit them all. As she'd noted earlier, the cellar was well ventilated and dry. A slight breeze blew through it, coming from a ventilation shaft somewhere, installed to stop the air from going stale and musty. She walked to one end of the room, placed her back against the wall, and paced carefully to the far end. One of the skills she had learned with Will was how to pace out distance, taking long steps that were consistent in length. She knew from her practice and training that 12 of these elongated paces were equivalent to 10 metres. She counted aloud now as she measured the length of the room. 34, 35 and a half,
she said, as her right foot butted against the base of the far wall. That was close enough to 36, which would coincide with the 30 meters marked on the plan in the library. She examined the wall. It was made of large blocks of sandstone, fitted together and cemented in place. She rapped on several of them with the hilt of her sax. They sounded solid enough. "Hmm," she muttered, casting a glance around the long, low-ceilinged room. There was nothing remarkable about it. The walls were bare. The room was unfurnished, aside from the racks of wine barrels and the wooden bins of vegetables at the far end. "Let's see downstairs," she said, and headed for the staircase that sloped down to the next level. Cellar 2 was not as well lit as the upper level, and there were no wine barrels stored here. But it was still relatively dry, although there was a faint hint of mustiness in the air. The ventilating breeze upstairs was not evident here. Maddie took a few minutes to study the long, shadowy room. It appeared to be identical to its upper neighbour. Once again, she moved to the far wall, placed her back against it, and began to pace, counting aloud as she did. Her voice echoed off the stone walls on either side. The open doors of the cells were dark holes, like eyes watching her. 28, 29, 30, 31, and that's it, she said, as she fetched up against the wall once more. She rubbed her chin. Near enough to 25 meters, she said reflectively. Definitely shorter than the room upstairs. She turned and paced once more, measuring the length of the room in the other direction. Again, she managed 31 paces before her toe stubbed against the base of the wall. There was no doubt about it. This room was 5 meters shorter than the one above. But why should it be? She took down one of the hanging lanterns and moved to the far wall again, studying it in fine detail. Like the wall upstairs, it was made from large sandstone blocks. The mortar between them was old but firm. It hadn't begun to deteriorate with age. She inched her way along the wall, peering closely at it, holding the lantern high to shed its light on the stone, then holding it at an angle so that any anomalies might be highlighted. Nothing. Then she noticed something on the end block, at the base. She bent for a closer look. 3 words were written there, or rather, the same word was written there 3 times. Sinister. 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 The lettering was small. It had been carved into the stone, presumably with a sharp-pointed tool, and if she hadn't been looking so closely, with the light angled to throw the words into relief, she might well have missed them. Sinister, she said to herself, then shrugged. Not a bad description for a dungeon. Although, as she'd noticed earlier, it wasn't a particularly appropriate description of this dungeon. It was dimly lit and low-ceilinged, yes, but it was dry and free of vermin, or the sort of tools of torture that were features of many dungeons. No rack, no chains or fetters in sight. She pushed open the door to the last cell in line and went inside, holding the lantern high to throw its light into the farthest corner. The walls were rough but dry. A battered, old wooden bed frame stood along the longer wall, and the door, made of iron-bound wood, had a small barred window in its upper half, allowing light and air into the cell. A small wooden table and stool completed the furnishings. There was even a stub of a candle, old and yellowed with age, on the table. It certainly wasn't luxurious, she thought, but it could have been a whole lot worse.
The worst you could say about it was that the hard wooden cot might be somewhat uncomfortable. But sinister? Not really. She exited the cell and looked around, wondering why someone had carved those words into the stone, wondering who had carved them. A prisoner, she said, then discarded that idea. A prisoner would have been in the cell itself. If he wanted to carve a message, he would have done it in there. She couldn't see any jailer allowing a prisoner out to vent his feelings on the wall itself. It was a puzzle, and she sighed as she contemplated it. "Put it out of your mind," she told herself. She knew that was the best way to find an answer to puzzles like this. But, of course, as soon as she tried to push the thought aside, it clouded back into her consciousness. Why was it written there? And why was this room 5 meters shorter than the one above it? Was there another room behind that stone wall? And if so, how did one gain access to it? She studied the wall again. She could see no sign of a door in the wall, or any kind of opening. The mortar was all solid, with no cracks visible. Her stomach rumbled loudly, reminding her that it was getting close to the time for the midday meal. "Going hungry won't solve the puzzle," she said, and mounted the stairs, heading for the buttery on the ground floor of the keep. "Maybe a full stomach will help you solve the riddle." As it turned out, it didn't, but it solved the problem of her rumbling stomach. After a substantial lunch, she decided to leave the puzzle of the cellars for a few hours. She hadn't seen Bumper in 2 days. She collected her belongings from the library and thanked Uldred. "Giving up?" he smiled, although there was a tone of disappointment in his voice. She shook her head. "Taking a break? I need some fresh air to help my thinking." She left the library and headed for the stables to saddle Sundancer, cramming several apples into her jacket pocket as she went. She rode to the farm, where Lou greeted her warmly. Warwick was working on one of the outlying fields. Leading Sundancer to the barn, she unsaddled him, gave him a brief rubdown and an apple, then tossed the saddle over Bumper's back.
"Wondered where you'd been?"
"Sorry, I've been busy."
She was preoccupied as she rode through the fields toward the hill where the old abbey was situated. She inspected the building once more, but it was unchanged. After patrolling the surrounding area for an hour, and finding nothing to arouse her interest or suspicion, she returned to the barn, deep in thought, changed her saddle over, and rode back to Castle Araluin, waving a farewell to Lou as she left. She clattered across the drawbridge, nodded a greeting to the sentries stationed there. At the stable, a stable boy took Sundancer's reins from her.
"We'll settle him down, my lady," he said cheerfully.
She was going to demur, then shrugged. One of the perks of being a princess was that people tended to do this sort of menial task for you. She left Sundancer in his care and mounted the stairs to her rooms, where she asked the servants to draw her a bath. Again, it occurred to her that, had she been back at Redmond, she would have had to perform this task for herself. "I didn't ask to be summoned here," she said. "May as well take advantage of it." Her shoulder and neck muscles were stiff, a result of sitting hunched over the charts in the library. She lay back in the hot, soothing water for half an hour, feeling the tension in her muscles release and her limbs relax. Then she clambered out of the bath, wrapping herself in a full-length towel, and spilling a substantial amount of the now lukewarm water on the flagstones as she did so. She contemplated mopping it up and grinned. Normally, she would do that, but here she was a princess, with servants just waiting to look after her every need. She compromised by apologizing to the maid, who hurried in at her call to dry the floor and empty the bath.
"No trouble, my lady," the girl said cheerfully.
"See," said Maddie to herself, to assuage the guilt. "She wants to look after you." She had an early dinner by herself. Her mother was attending to the details of an upcoming official visit by the newly appointed Iberian ambassador, and Maddie didn't want to bother her. Diamond was on duty, again, so she was left to her own devices. Which suited Maddie, as she pondered the mystery of that 5-meter discrepancy and the apparent lack of any way through the stone wall. Eventually, with no solution coming to her, she decided to go to bed. It had been a long day, poring over charts and measurements, descending into the cellars, then riding to Warwick and Lewes Farm and beyond. It was warm and cozy under her blankets, leaving the window open so that the chill night air would cool the room. She pulled the blankets up to her chin, luxuriating in their warmth. She stretched her legs out, yawned twice, and let her eyes close. Her breathing became deep and regular. Then, suddenly, she sat up in bed. "Sinister means left." 14. It was close to midday when the little company rode out of the trees onto grassy flatland. Beyond the knee-high grass that waved gently in the breeze, Horace could see the silver sparkle of water stretching for several hundred meters to the north. "That's the Weasel," he said. Gillen nodded acknowledgement. "And there are our two scouts," he replied, indicating the two mounted troopers waiting by the riverbank. Horace turned in his saddle and beckoned the troop leader forward. The lieutenant trotted his horse up to them. Protocol dictated that, while they were marching, he would stay a reasonable distance from the two commanders, allowing them to speak in relative privacy. He saluted as he drew rein alongside them. "Wait here," Horace told him, then indicated the two scouts several hundred meters away. "We'll check with the scouts, and if it's all clear, we'll signal you forward."
"Are you planning to stop here for a while, sir?"
the lieutenant asked. Horace squinted up at the sun, almost directly overhead.
"We might as well rest the horses.
And the archers," he added with a grin. The archers, being unmounted, marched in the rear of the cavalry. "But wait till we hear what the scouts have to say."
"Yes, sir."
The lieutenant touched his hand to the rim of his iron helmet, then turned away and issued commands to his troop.
"Stay mounted, but sit at rest," he told them.
The troopers eased their tired legs, standing in their stirrups and stretching their muscles. The archers who accompanied them simply sat or lay on the grass at the edge of the track, with sighs of relief. Horace and Gillen urged their mounts into a canter and rode toward the two scouts.
"Looks as if everything's all right," Gillen observed.
Had the scouts intended to warn them of danger, they would have signalled so by now. As it was, they sat at ease and waited for the two commanders to come up with them. It was Horace's operation, so Gillen left it to him to question the two riders.
"Where are the foxes?" Horace asked.
Since early that morning, following a tip-off from a village they had passed through, they had been shadowing a small group of members of the Red Fox clan. There were half a dozen of them, and they had been moving at a brisk pace through the wooded country, consistently heading north.
"Must be going somewhere," Gillen had noted.
Horace had grunted assent. Obviously the foxes were going somewhere, he'd thought. But he realized that Gillen had meant they had a definite destination in mind. In spite of the vagaries of the tracks through the forest they had been following, They had maintained a base course that travelled consistently north. Now the broad, deep waters of the Weasel prohibited any further progress in that direction. The foxes must have turned either east or west. And presumably, the two scouts had waited to apprise Horace and Gillen of their quarry's new course. The senior of the two scouts, who wore corporal's rank insignia on the chest of his jerkin, saluted briskly. Horace nodded acknowledgement, and briefly touched his forehead with his forefinger. He wasn't much for parade ground drill, Gillen noted with a private smile.
"Sir," said the corporal briskly, "we followed them here, to the river's edge. Then they turned east, following the bank."
He indicated the direction they had taken with a pointing arm. "Do they know you are following them?" Horace asked. The corporal hesitated.
"Hard to tell, sir," he said. "They didn't seem to know we were behind them. We stayed well back. Of course," he added, "it was easier to stay concealed when we were in the trees. They could have spotted us when we reached this open ground."
Horace considered the man's answer for a few seconds. Short of having the six fox members spur off at full gallop, there was no way of ascertaining whether they had spotted their followers.
"Hmm," he said. "How long since they reached this point?"
The two scouts exchanged a glance, and then the corporal replied.
"Half an hour, sir. 20 minutes at least."
He looked back at his companion again.
"Would you say so, Ned?"
The second trooper nodded.
20 minutes at least, sir."
Horace glanced to the east, in the direction the small party had gone, and came to a decision.
"Very well. Get back on their tail," he said. "Stay well back."
He indicated the tree line several hundred meters away.
"You can stay back in the trees."
"Yes, sir," the corporal replied.
Horace continued with his orders.
"We'll take a 10-minute break here and follow on after you. If there's anything to report, or if they change direction again, one of you ride back to tell us."
"Yes, sir,"
the troopers chorused. Horace waved them away.
"Right, get moving. But be careful. Odds are, they're heading for some meeting point or rendezvous, and we don't want to frighten them off."
The two troopers cantered slowly away, their horses' hooves thudding dully on the soft grass. Horace turned in his saddle, whistled, and then waved for the rest of the party to join them. Gillen unhooked his canteen from the saddle bow in front of him and took a long drink.
"Might as well stretch our legs," Horace told him.
Then, as the troop arrived, with the archers straggling loosely behind, he addressed the lieutenant.
10 minutes, Burton," he told him. "Let the men dismount and loosen saddle girths. Check the horses for any signs of lameness or galling."
The lieutenant nodded, then turned and issued his orders to the troop. The cavalrymen swung down from their saddles and began to check their mounts. It was standard procedure to make sure the horses were in good shape before they attended to their own needs. Each man was leading a spare horse, and they were checked as well. Although, without being burdened by a saddle or a rider, there was little chance that they would need any form of treatment. As before, the archers simply sprawled on the grass where they stood. There were, after all, some advantages to travelling on foot. Horace grinned at them.
"Undisciplined lot they are," he said.
Gillen followed his gaze and replied seriously.
"Maybe, but they're good men in a battle."
"Let's hope so,"
the tall knight replied. "We might need them before long." After the 10-minute break was over, measured by the troop sergeant with a small sand glass, the men tightened their saddle girth straps and remounted. Grumbling, the archers came to their feet and stood ready in a loose formation. Horace raised his right hand to shoulder height, then lowered it in the direction he wanted them to travel. "Move them out, Lieutenant," he said, and once again the little force was on the move. They travelled for another hour, walking the horses so that the archers could keep up. There were no complaints from the bowmen. They were used to going on foot. Their feet and leg muscles were hardened to the task, and they managed a brisk pace that kept them level with the horsemen. They paralleled the river bank. As Gillen and Horace had predicted back at Castle Araluen, it formed an effective barrier, keeping the party ahead of them from crossing. Gillen held up a hand, and the column stopped.
"What is it?" said Horace.
Then he saw for himself, as his eyes followed Gillen's outstretched arm. The two scouts were reined in on the bank of the river, waiting for them. They were about 300 meters ahead.
"You've got sharp eyes," he told the ranger commandant.
"Something's happened. Wonder why one of them didn't ride back to warn us," said Gillen.
The reason soon became apparent, as they spurred their horses to join the scouts.
"They got away, sir,"
the corporal said apologetically. Horace's brows drew together in annoyance.
"Got away? How?"
"I told you to stay back out of sight, didn't I?"
"And we did, sir.
But I think they've been on to us the whole time, only they never let on. There was a boat waiting for them here."
He indicated a shallow sandy beach at the river's edge. "Took them on board and rowed them across the river.
We couldn't do anything about it, sir. We were staying back, and they got on board before we knew what was happening."
Horace let his breath out in an exasperated sigh.
"Can't be helped, Corporal," he said. "Not your fault. As you say, it seems they've been on to us the whole time."
He twisted in his saddle.
"Lieutenant," he called,
beckoning for the officer to join them. As the man rode up, Horace indicated the cavalrymen.
"Any of your men raised in these parts?" he asked.
"I'd like to know if there's a ford anywhere close by."
The lieutenant looked doubtful.
"Not sure, sir. Most of them came from the south originally, but I'll ask around."
"No need," Gillen said. "One of the archers grew up here. Used to be a poacher before he signed up with the archers. He should know the area."
He raised his voice.
"Archer Ellis! Come here, please!"
Ellis, a nuggety man in his mid-30s, heaved himself to his feet. Like the others, he had taken the opportunity to sprawl on the grass by the riverbank. He hurried forward now. Gillen noted approvingly that he brought his longbow with him. No archer worth his salt would ever leave it behind when on campaign. Ellis saluted, touching the knuckles of his right hand to his forehead.
"Yes, Ranger,"
he said smartly. Gillen commanded the respect of the archers. As a ranger, Gillen's skill with the bow was far superior to their own, and they recognized the fact.
"You were raised around here, weren't you? Used to be a poacher, I'm told," Gillen said.
Instantly, Ellis assumed a look of shocked innocence.
"Me, sir? A poacher, sir? Nay, I never touched one of the king's animals. It's a wicked lie folks tell about me, it is."
Gillen said nothing, simply stared down at the man with a look of utter disbelief on his face. Ellis shifted his feet uncomfortably, then eventually admitted,
"Well, maybe once, twice, even. I might have accidentally shot a rabbit or a hare. Accidentally, I say. And once it was shot, weren't no sense to leaving it lying around, were there?"
"Oh, get over yourself, Ellis. I don't care if you shot 50 deer while you were at it. The question is, how well do you know this area?"
Ellis glanced around, as if seeing the river, the grassy plain, and the forest for the first time.
"Why, lock the back of my hand, sir.
he said, relieved that the question of his former illegal activities was not Gillen's main interest.
So, are there any fords close by? Gillen asked.
Ellis pursed his lips, considering.
Not particularly close, sir. Nearest is a good 2 kilometres from here, and it's a difficult crossing, sir.
How's that?